the question that we're exploring, and one of the things we're talking about today is fear. And the question we've asked is, what are you afraid of? And we have a blackboard in the back and encourage you sometime during the service. You can do it in the middle of the sermon to just get up and walk back there and write an answer to that question. What are you afraid of? And if my family could go back there and write one collective answer, it would be this: spiders, right? Yes, you are. Come on now. Because we have this discussion, anytime we find a spider in our house, there's always this sort of, not an argument, just a discussion about who's going to get it. And there are several factors that come into play, whose room it was found in, who got the last spider. And so all those things are discussed. And honestly, I would get all of them because I mean, I'm not really afraid of spiders. And Janice informed me when we got married that that was my only responsibility as the man of the house, that that was my job and that was the primary responsibility of a husband, never mind love and fidelity and security or any of those things. The man of the house should always get the spiders. But here's the deal. We all have things like that in our lives that we're afraid of that are more like a nuisance, right? Spiders or snakes or the dark, or maybe it's horror movies and so you just avoid horror movies. But the truth is, we also have things in our lives that we're genuinely afraid of. Things that guide our thoughts and our feelings and our actions a whole lot more than we're willing to admit. Maybe for you it's a fear of failure. Maybe you're deathly afraid of failing at anything. And so you'll pursue success at all costs and you won't do anything if there's even a risk of failure. Or maybe it's a fear of rejection. Maybe it's a fear of what others think about you. And so for the most part, you are always managing your image or your reputation or what others might think or how they might perceive you because you just desperately desire the approval and the affection and the love of everyone else around you. Maybe it's a fear of the unknown, right? Maybe you look out into the future and you're scared of anything that bad that might happen, and so you make plans and you make contingencies and you have backup plans to the other plans and you have backup plans to those plans to just plan for any possible thing that could go wrong because you never want to be taken by surprise. You never want anything to enter your life that you haven't planned for or prepared for. Maybe it's fear of the unknown future. Maybe it's a fear of conflict, and so you avoid that at all costs. Maybe it's a fear of intimacy, so you don't let anyone ever get close to you. And I could go on and on, but the truth is, some of us are enslaved by our fears. We can be imprisoned and dominated and ruled by our fears. But what if we could be rescued from them? What if we could be delivered from them? What if we could actually live a life where fears exist? You can't eliminate them altogether, but they don't rule our thinking. They don't guide our lives. Maybe you know somebody that's like that. They're fearless, right? You maybe have that one friend, and you look at them, and they just, maybe it's something in their personality, but they just don't seem to be afraid of things. They don't seem to be afraid of trying things out and totally failing at them, falling flat on their face, or they don't seem to be afraid or fear other people rejecting them or not liking them, and they're not always thinking about what other people think, and they might be nice and kind and generous, but they do those things just out of some other place, not because they want the approval of others. And you look at these people and you think, oh, how liberating would it be to be that fearless, to walk through life and not be guided by what are other people going to think about it or how much success can I have and what if I don't succeed and what if this happens or what if somebody hurts me and I should never get too close to them because they're eventually going to burn me. What if I could go through life like that? But then you think of the consequences. And you look at those people and you think, they probably have a lot of failure. They make a lot of mistakes. They get burned by people and taken advantage of people. There's all kinds of things that come into their lives that they haven't thought about, that they haven't prepared for, that they're not planned for. And those consequences are just too great for you to live with. So you remain primarily guided by fear. We're during this season of Lent, which we begin on Wednesday, Ash Wednesday. We're looking at the book of Exodus and the story of Exodus. As Brian mentioned earlier, the story of Exodus is really about three big things. It's about how God rescued the people of Israel from slavery in Egypt, and then how God was with them as they walked through the wilderness together, and then how God was always directing them or leading them towards a new life and a new land with Him. What if fear is your Egypt? What if fear is the thing that you need to be rescued from? What if fear is the thing that rules you or imprisons you or enslaves you, and you need to figure out how to leave that behind and be rescued from it or delivered from it by God? Today, we're going to look at the story of a handful of women who are fearless, who weren't ruled by fear, who stood in the face of their fears and then defied their fears. It's found at the beginning of Exodus, and the beginning of Exodus tells us sort of the backdrop of the Israelites' condition and how they had grown so much, and then how the Egyptians began to force labor and oppression upon them. And then this is what it says in Exodus chapter 1, starting in verse 15. It says, "The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, 'When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live.'" Now, the king of Egypt is someone who is a great example of a person who's driven by fear. Right? In fact, right before this, it says that he and all the other leaders of Egypt at that time are scared of the Israelites. They're scared of this growing sort of immigrant class of people that are in their land, and they're scared that as they grow and get more and more numerous, that eventually they're going to raise up one day and maybe rebel against them or maybe take over or maybe threaten their power. And so Pharaoh and the leaders of Egypt are scared, and they begin to come up with plans. And one of the plans is, well, we won't give them any rights, and we'll give them all the difficult jobs, and we'll force harsh labor and harsh conditions upon them, and they essentially become the servants or the serfs, or we could even say the slaves of the Egyptians. But then the king of Egypt or Pharaoh comes up with another plan. As he looks way out in the distance and he sees that they're going to keep growing and this is going to keep becoming a threat to us, he knows that it's mainly the Hebrew men. It's mainly young Hebrew men that grow up and are strong and could potentially become a fighting force that are the biggest threat. And so he comes up with this plan. And he knows he needs to execute this plan quietly, because there are some morals and there are some standards in Egyptian society at that time. He can't just send soldiers to Israelites' houses and just start killing young Hebrew men. So he comes up with this plan, and he goes to these midwives and he orders them. And it's a long-range plan. I mean, this plan isn't really going to have an effect until 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road. But he orders them, when you show up a Hebrew woman's home and she's about to deliver, when you're there to help them deliver the child, immediately see, as a midwife can see, if it's a boy or a girl, and if it's a boy, kill him. And that sounds odd to us or strange to us, and how could that even happen? And the idea is that maybe they could strangle or kill this child before the mother even realizes. And remember, at that time, the infant mortality rate's really high. There's lots of stillborn children. So this wouldn't have maybe been totally strange for mothers to go through this. And so the order comes from Pharaoh: I want you to do this, and in this way, it will eliminate an entire generation of a potential threat to my power. Now, there's a couple of interesting things going on here. First, Pharaoh gives this order to two midwives, and we think, were there really only two midwives in all the Israelites? And no, there weren't. These two women probably oversaw all of the midwives. There was probably a whole class and a whole group of midwives, and these two women were chiefly responsible for overseeing them, which means they were the ones who would have to answer to Pharaoh directly if his orders weren't obeyed. Here's another interesting thing. We're told their names, Shiphrah and Puah. We're told their names. And later, we'll be told a couple of other women's names, Jochebed and Miriam. And in the course of this story, we're told these four women's names, which means these are real people. These are real women. These are not just anonymous characters in the story. We're going to know them by name, which also means God knows them by name. And what's interesting is we're not told the name of the king of Egypt at the time. We're not told Pharaoh's name, although everyone else would have known it. We're not told any of the other Egyptian officials' names. We're not told any of Pharaoh's family names, which is fascinating because there will be all kinds of official Egyptian records that will tell their names. There will be all kinds of inscriptions that will tout all of their accomplishments, and none of those records and none of those inscriptions will even mention the Israelites. But it's as if the Old Testament has a totally different perspective and God has a different perspective. And he says, these people may be important in the eyes of everyone else in this mighty kingdom at the time, but you need to know these four women are way more important. You're going to know their names. So we find out their names and look at what happens next. Verse 17, it says, the midwives, however, feared God. And they did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. And then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? And the midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. So Shiphrah and Puah intentionally disobey this order. And it probably goes on for months, maybe years. I mean, we read this story as if something happened next, but this probably goes on for months and maybe even years, because remember, Pharaoh's trying to do this quietly, so it's not like he's sending soldiers to every single home to check up and to make sure that the midwives are actually doing this. He just assumes that they're obeying his orders, right? Because that's what people do. You would never not obey what Pharaoh said to do. He's the king, he is the ultimate authority. And if he says that this is what you have to do, then this is what you have to do. He knows they're going to follow his orders, because if they don't follow his orders, they're going to have to pay the consequences. They're going to have to answer to him. And yet, maybe a few years goes by, and it actually becomes apparent when the population of young Hebrew male babies isn't actually going down that they weren't doing what he told them to do. So he calls them in front of him, and they're going to have to come to his court and answer for their disobedience. And he asks them this question, and what do they do when he asks them the question? They basically lie. They lie straight to the Pharaoh's face. They say, well, we just couldn't get there in time. The midwives that we oversee, we just couldn't get to their houses in time to actually do anything about all these babies being born. And there's even this little slight, this little shot that's taken Egyptians. And by the way, you know, they're not like Egyptian women who just start crying out right when they go into labor and give me the epidural and all that. Like they're not like that. Hebrew women are strong. They just do it, and they don't even tell us it's happening. And then we show up, and they're already back at work, and the baby's born. And we just, I mean, like we couldn't do anything about it, right? And so they lie to Pharaoh, which is interesting. Isn't it always wrong to lie? Isn't that what mom and dad told you, right? Isn't that what one of the Ten Commandments is? Thou shalt not lie. Right, no, that's not what it says. It doesn't say that. It actually says you shouldn't give false witness or false testimony against your neighbor, most likely in the context of a court. That when someone's life is at stake, then you need to tell the truth. When there's a court case that's happening, and when you're testifying against your neighbor, when there's some context like that, then you need to tell the truth. That telling the truth, the Bible essentially is a broader picture. The Bible upholds this idea that telling the truth is a really important and good part of truthful and good and honest relationships. And so when you have honest relationships like that in your family or in a court system, then yeah, you tell the truth. It's part of that. It upholds those relationships. But when the Nazis are asking if you're hiding any Jews, you lie. Just like a lot of followers of Jesus did during World War II. And if Pharaoh orders you to commit atrocities and to murder children, you lie. I mean, all bets are off. When the powerful are oppressing the powerless, and there is no standard of truth, and there is no relationship or system, then yeah, it's okay. You lie. So Shiphrah and Puah lie, and they choose to defy the king of Egypt. They disobey his order. They lie in front of him when they're confronted about it, and they do everything they can to keep this atrocity from happening. And why? It says because they feared God. That's the only explanation we're given. When so many other fears are at play, Pharaoh is afraid of the Israelites. The Israelites are afraid of Pharaoh. The midwives should be afraid of Pharaoh because they've been given an order, and if they don't obey the order, then they should fear the consequences of not obeying the order. But in the midst of all that, it says a different fear rules their heart and governs their actions. It's as if this different fear supplants all those other fears. It's because they feared God instead. And we'll unpack what that means in a second, but here's what happens as a result. Verse 20, it says, so God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, we're told again, he gave them families of their own. And we're not exactly sure what this meant. Maybe they didn't have children at that time. Maybe these midwives were infertile or barren. Maybe that's why they were midwives and God blessed their courage and fearlessness in the midst of this. We're not really sure, but it says, then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people, every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. So after trying secretly for years to deal with this fear and this threat, this thing that he's so afraid of, to make up all of these plans, Pharaoh's had enough. And he finally goes public with a new plan and a new policy that everyone knows now, which can only be described as ethnic genocide, right? There's another story that follows immediately after this one. I want to read it briefly for you today. It's probably the more famous story. This is what it says in the next verse, Exodus 2, verse 1. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman. That's going to be important down the road to know that these two parents are both from the tribe of Levi. We don't need to worry about it now. But it says, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. And then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. So this is one of the Hebrew boys that's been born after this order has been given, and all baby boys are supposed to be thrown into the Nile. At the time, the Nile was believed to be a god in Egypt. They worshiped the Nile like it was a god. And so the Egyptian people might have even interpreted this order from Pharaoh as a way of making the Hebrew people sacrifice their children to the Egyptian god. They might have said, that's not murder. This is just the penalty, or this is just the cost you pay. If you want to live in our society, you have to show allegiance to our gods. But we're told that Amram and Jochebed, we're not told their names here, but later in the story of Exodus, that's their names, a man named Amram and a woman named Jochebed. We're told that they have this child and they disobey this order. She hides the child for 3 months in her home, and then the child starts getting a little unruly, and he's crying a lot, and it's getting more difficult to hide him, and she's maybe worried that soldiers or taskmaster or someone will come by and discover the child. And so she decides to hide him in the reeds in the Nile River. And we're not sure why. She might not even be trying to give the child up. Maybe she thinks that I'll hide him down there. They apparently live near the Nile River, and I can hide him down there, and the current goes by in the main river, and it's loud, and no one will hear the child crying, and I'll send my daughter down there to check on him every now and then so no one could come by our house and find the child in our house during the day, and maybe we'll bring him back at night. We don't know if that was her thinking, or we don't know if she actually was trying to give the child up. We don't know. Maybe she didn't know. Maybe she's just doing the best she can. Maybe she doesn't have a plan and all sorts of contingency things. Maybe she's just trusting that God will take care of this child. And so she puts him in a basket. And actually, it wasn't a basket. That's not a very good translation of the word. The translations here are really good for everything else, but that one word, it's not really a basket. The Hebrew word that's used there is the same word used in Genesis to translate what we now say ark. The same word used when Noah builds, he doesn't build a basket, right? It's a really big basket. He builds an ark. The word there is ark. Ark just means, it usually referred to a piece of furniture that was a storage, that stored things, a storage container that kept things safe. That's why it's used to describe this huge boat, that it's going to keep this family and all these animals safe. And so that's what she uses. Think about maybe a chest that we would have at the end of a bed. She takes this piece of furniture, it probably has a lid on it that closes it up. In fact, later in the passage it says when the baby's found, they opened it up. You don't open a basket. They opened up this ark or this piece of furniture. She puts pitch and tar around it to waterproof it, and then uses some Gore-Tex to make sure it's breathable. And I don't know. Maybe she drilled holes in the top or something like that. But then Jochebed takes this chest, this little baby in it, down to the river and hides him in the reeds and tells her daughter, which we're pretty sure is probably Miriam. Maybe she's 8, 10, 12 years old, we don't know, to go down there and keep watch. And then look at what happens. Verse 5 says, then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket, or the ark, among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby, and he was crying, and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. And then his sister, that would be Miriam, who happened to be there, asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse this baby for you? In other words, if you want to take care of this baby and help this baby, I could go find a Hebrew woman who's maybe in the stages of nursing and she could help out. And it goes on and it says, yes, go, she answered. So the girl, that's Miriam, went and got the baby's mother, Jochebed. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. And when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. That's interesting. Moses in Egyptian means son. So this is probably Pharaoh's daughter naming him Moses when she adopted him, saying, now I have a son. It's probably an Egyptian name, but the Egyptian word for son is really, really similar to the Hebrew word for to take out of or to draw out of. And so the author of the story and later Israelites would interpret this as this refers to the way this little boy was rescued from the water and saved. So four women, Shifra, Pua, Jochebed, and Miriam, who was probably just a little girl at the time, defy the king of Egypt. They risk their lives, and it's through their actions and what they do that God raises up the deliverer and who's going to be the savior for the entire people of Israel. But here's what's interesting, and here's what we're going to see next week. Moses, when he grows up, is actually a pretty fearful guy. He's afraid of what Pharaoh's going to do. He's afraid of his reputation among the people. He's afraid of being a failure. The Israelites, too, are afraid. They're afraid when they get into the wilderness of all the challenges they're going to face there. They're afraid of the Egyptians who begin to follow them there. They're afraid when they come to the footsteps of the promised land. They look in and they say, oh, I don't think we can take it. We're afraid of that. Pharaoh himself is the epitome of fear, right? He's afraid of the Israelites. He's afraid that his reputation is going to be challenged. He's afraid that they're going to rebel against him. He's afraid when Moses begins challenging him that people are going to follow Moses and he's going to steal all of his glory. Pharaoh becomes this man whose heart is ruled by fear, and he ends up making horrible decisions for the entire nation as a result of it. And then you have Shifra and Pua and Jochebed and Miriam. And they're not afraid. They're willing to take risks. They're willing to do what they think is right. They're willing to face their fears. I mean, maybe they are afraid. Maybe they feel the fear, but they're able to face their fears and overcome them. Not be ruled and dominated by their fears, but to supplant their fears with something deeper. And Exodus tells us what supplanted their fears was just a different kind of fear. It was the fear of God. The women feared God. They didn't fear Pharaoh. They didn't fear failure. They didn't fear the consequences of their actions. They simply feared God. If I can pull it all together in a few statements, here's the first. This is what's true of all of our fears. You serve what you fear. You serve what you fear. You become a servant or a slave of the very thing you fear or of your fear itself. If you fear failure, you'll do everything at all costs to be successful and to never fail. If you fear rejection and you want approval from people, you'll do everything. You'll spend so much time in the morning just thinking about what you're going to wear, and you'll start going through all the people you're going to see that day and what they're going to think of when they see you in that outfit and how you might appear to them. And you'll, everything you do, everything you think, every action you take, every word you say, everything you buy will be consumed with this idea of how can I impress and gain the approval of others. You'll be ruled by that fear. You'll become a servant of that fear. The story of Exodus actually uses this word serve. In Hebrew, it's the word abad. It uses it over and over and over and over. It uses it to describe the way that the Israelites serve Pharaoh. They labor for Pharaoh, same word. They work hard for Pharaoh. He pushed forced labor upon them. He rules over them. They become his servants or his slaves. And then in contrast, what does God say a few chapters later? Here's what I want you to do, Pharaoh. Let my people go that they may come and serve me. That they may give their lives to me. And these women in the very beginning of the story show us what that's like. They don't serve Pharaoh and they don't serve their fears. They serve God because they fear him instead. Now, there's a big difference between our other fears and fearing God. And so here's a second statement for you. Fear is enslaving. Fear of God is liberating. You see, when your life becomes dominated by a fear of failure or a fear of rejection or a fear of intimacy or a fear of conflict or a fear of the unknown, whatever it is, you can try to do every single possible thing you can to mitigate those fears. You can try to be as successful as you want. You can try to be as loved. You can try to mitigate all harm or all hurt that could come into your life. But you never actually get there, right? You can't eliminate all of the risk. You can try harder. You can plan better. But eventually you'll be hurt. Eventually you will fail. But in the process of all of that, you know what your fear will whisper into your ear? It'll say, you just need to try harder next time. Then you won't fail. You just need to look better next time, and then they'll be impressed by you. You just need to keep your distance better next time, and then you won't be hurt by him or by her. And that's enslaving. That creates a prison for us. But here's the difference. Fear of God is liberating. It's so different because God, yes, he is a king, and yes, he wants us to serve him, and yes, he wants us to come before him and obey him and actually surrender our lives to him. It's why Jesus talks about this all the time when he shows up, the kingdom of God. A new king has arrived, and you can live your life under this new king, but he's a different kind of king. He's a loving king. He wants what's best for us. He wants what's best for our lives. He wants to actually rescue us from our Egypts and the things that enslave us. And his love for us isn't dependent on how good we serve him. It doesn't matter if you fail. And it doesn't matter if you're not always perfect in the way you serve him. He doesn't love you based on how well you serve him. He simply loves you because he's a good king and he's a good father to us. You see, other fears are enslaving, but the fear of God is liberating. There's one other thing about this. The fear is about control. Fear of God is about trust. When you're afraid of something, what do? You cling to control. You maintain this death grip on control because you and I tend to think, if I just work hard enough, if I just try harder, if I just get better at this, then I can get this thing under control. I'll never be taken by surprise again. I'll never be hurt again. And we try to manage our fears by staying in control, but we know, right? Control is an illusion. It's not real. We try to think we can control our lives from sort of Monday to Saturday, but when we come here on Sunday, we acknowledge and we sing and we confess we're not really in control. Only God is in control. And that's where God comes in, because fearing God says, I'm not in control, but I'm going to trust that he is. And I'm going to face this scary situation, and I'm going to take some risk, and I'm going to entrust the outcome to him. That's what the four women did. We're going to defy Pharaoh, which is silly. Nobody defies Pharaoh and lives, right? But we know it's right. And so we're going to do it, and we're going to trust that God will take care of us. We're going to hand over the outcome of this situation to God. Now, few of us are probably in life and death situations like these Hebrew women were. But I think their example raises some important questions for us this morning. What fear are you serving right now? What are you afraid of? And you're serving that fear. Where are you ruled or dominated by a specific fear in your life? Where are you trying to hold on to control over something or over a circumstance in your life because you're scared of what's going to happen if you let go? Where do you need to just simply trust in God? Face your fear and leave that fear behind and be willing to say, and maybe it doesn't happen in one day, but maybe it's a whole season. Maybe that's what this Lent journey for you is going to be like, saying, I want to leave that behind. I don't want to live a life ruled by fear anymore. And so I need you, God, to rescue me from that and bring me to a place where I trust in you more. Let me pray for us. God, I think that's our desire for all of us this morning, is that we wouldn't be people who are ruled by our fears. I'm mindful of that passage in the New Testament where Paul wrote that we're your children. We've been adopted as your sons and daughters, and so we have nothing to fear because you love us, and you'll always be there for us, and you hear our cries when we're in Egypt, and you're with us in the wilderness, even though we sometimes don't see it or we don't feel it. You're there, and you're present in all of our circumstances, and you'll never leave us, and you'll never forsake us. So God, I pray that your love would cast out our fear today. I pray that as we sing about this, and as we explore it, and as we think about it for the rest of today and the rest of this week, that we would be reminded that a different kind of fear can rule our hearts. A fear of you, one that's not a place where we're scared of you, but where we trust in you. We revere you. We know that you're in our corner, that you have our back, and that you'll always be with us. I pray this in your name. Amen.